The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
And welcome back. It's Friday, and we are approaching the last week of February already. It's the 21st. Next Friday is the 28th. And as you know, February is, that's it, 28th. We're done. Harry Cooper is our first guest tonight. This is going to be an historic program in the best sense of the word, because what we're going to do is present a book that many of you have already seen at the top of rents.com that we'll do a great deal of rolling back the veil of lies and deception and the twisted version of history that we are taught as children and as adults. This is an extraordinary book. The research into it is unmatched. Harry Cooper first wrote a book about this very subject, Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun leaving Berlin, making it out of there, and ending up in Argentina. About 20 years ago, it was called Escape from the Bunker. As you can imagine, over the years, more and more information has come to light, especially via Harry's trips to Argentina and talking to some really extraordinary people down there. This book is a sequel, but it's more than a sequel. It is the whole story, with as much documentation as you're ever going to find about this. Over the years, unfortunately, others, and rather recently, have stolen Harry Cooper's first book, plagiarized it, ripped it off, and brought their own books out about Hitler's escape from Berlin. But they got it wrong. They came to conclusions that Harry never came to, and they're conclusions that do not match up to the facts. Harry has recently come back from a trip down there, and he has much to talk about. We're going to look at some photographs tonight that will be very illuminating to many of you. And the book, if you aren't on the internet right now and can't see it or haven't seen it, and by all means do go to the homepage at Rents, look at the book cover, click and look at the back cover, and then click and order it. It is at the printing press right now. It is being prepared for shipment, hopefully within 2 weeks. The book is entitled, very simply, Hitler in Argentina. Tells you the whole story. Many people are going to look at that title and say, wait a minute, that's a statement of a fact, not a supposition or a hypothesis. And in fact, it is a fact. Hitler was in Argentina. This is the documented truth of his escape from Berlin, his life in Argentina, and the two towns that he lived in. But more than that, I guess in a larger sense, it's where much of the upper echelons of the German government fled to after the war ended in April of 45. Now, the exodus to Argentina was carried out a number of different ways. And I'm here to tell you as a preface that I was talking to a friend of mine who is 72, I think. He has a friend who's 96. His 96-year-old friend was a P-51 pilot in the war in Europe, a hero. And at war's end, his entire squadron was held back. And what I was told by my friend, who knows this man for many years, was that these pilots were held in Germany, and incoming flights, plane after plane, of brand new shiny DC-4s, four engine, made by Douglas Aircraft, DC-4, with long-range fuel tanks, were flown to Germany and headquartered at least one airbase, if not two. These pilots were checked out on the DC floors and were given the task of flying trip after trip after trip from Germany to the Canary Islands to Argentina. Flying what? Flying what was called restricted cargo, Germans, government agents, bureaucrats, party members, SS, also cargo, valuables, documentation, all kinds of inanimate objects. There were apparently dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of flights, to move what was left of the existing German government to Argentina, where it went through a mass processing center, which you will see tonight in photographs and is covered in the book, and were given new names and identities and so forth. This is an enormous story, and you're saying to yourself, "Wow, Jeff, you're wrong, you're crazy. There's no way this government, who just fought Germany, would fly thousands of German government officials and their families out of Germany to Argentina." Well, I would suggest that there was a reason for that. There was a deal made, and the deal was that incredibly brilliant German technology, from rocketry to weapons, surface-to-air missiles, you name it, would be given to the Americans in exchange for the ability to many, many of the upper echelon German government families, individuals, to be flown along with their belongings and other things as well to Argentina. That was a trade-off. And if the deal hadn't been made with the Americans, guess who would get all of this technology or much of it? The Soviet Union. Nobody wanted that. This exodus so enraged Joseph Stalin that at Potsdam he was still obviously angry and said Hitler did not die in Berlin. He escaped to either Spain or Argentina. Well, the trail led apparently through both. So this is a background of the story. The book cover itself, David Dees did the front and back cover. I know Harry is very proud of that. I am too. It's a wonderful cover. It tells the story. There's a quite an interesting portrait of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun on the front cover. The house that they lived in Bariloche, southern Argentina, is right on the cover as well. That was built by the Mercedes family. And then you see an enormous six-engine Junkers aircraft at the top and a submarine at the bottom. We'll get into that a little bit later. That's as all has been said to this point, about as much as I'm going to say to this point. And let's bring Harry Cooper back on the program now. Hello, Harry, and welcome back. Congratulations. This is the book that could turn history finally into the light of day.
Well, we hope so. Good evening. It's good to be back.
You were just down there how many weeks ago?
I think I've been back about 2 weeks. Maybe I came back right at the end of January. I was there for 16 days. Beautiful country. Boy, I love Argentina.
And you went down there for what reason? What was the primary?
To get more questions answered. This is my fourth trip to Argentina. And this time we went to photograph some other places that, especially that compound that we'll talk about. You've seen pictures of it, where German personnel would go after the war to pick up their new identities. And we found out from the guy who is the caretaker that they were training German soldiers there after the war was over.
Mm-hmm. This is a story that has been kicked around recently by people who have taken your material and tried to expand upon it and create fictions to go along with it to make it more sensational. The real story is sensational enough. I mean, it's all right there.
I know. I've heard about some of these, and that some of them are kind of laughable. One came up recently where they claimed Hitler lived until he was 95 years old. He lived with some girl, I guess that was his mistress, in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And the photograph that was shown to be the so-called proof, it was so fuzzy you couldn't identify anybody.
Correct. It was silly. We'll go through the break, Todd. Thank you. That book is one of several that has been just basically a complete ripoff of yours. without the further data and research that you've come up with. Your sources are the best, period, that we're ever going to have. You've been on this trail for over 20 years.
Yeah, it started in 1985 when one of our members, a Spanish intel agent by the name of Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco, who was working for the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS intelligence at the end of the war. He sent me the story, which went into the book, Escape from the Bunker, and now we've incorporated that with another 150 pages additional in Hitler in Argentina. And he sent me this letter. It was typewritten, single-spaced, 114 pages long. And he told all about his time with the Sicherheitsdienst, and he told about how he saw Hitler physically forcibly drugged under orders of Martin Bormann and removed from the bunker, him and Eva Braun. And he thought Eva Braun had been overdosed and died, but that was not correct because we know she was in Argentina as well with Hitler. And we checked him out with a couple of spooks we knew, an American guy who was naval intelligence his whole career, and he retired as a captain, and he was NSA, and another fellow who was high-level Abwehr on the German side. They both confirmed he was indeed who he said he was. And the American agent, Captain Bob Thu, he had come for a visit. He was sitting on my sofa, and I asked him if he had ever heard of Don Angel, and he said, oh, yeah. He said, we knew he was a spy. He just was such a bad spy. Everybody knew he was a spy. And I said, well, this guy must be nuts because he sent me this letter and told me that Hitler didn't die in the bunker. I said, the guy must be nuts. And just as calmly as if he was asking for a cup of coffee, he said, no, we knew he didn't die in the bunker. And so I was kind of shocked. I said, we, who's we? And he says, the intelligence community. We knew Hitler got away. So from there on, I started researching. And then in 2008, I went my first time to Argentina, to Buenos Aires, and also Bariloche, which is where Hitler lived until 1955. Then I went back again the next year, same place, to Bariloche, and that's where this one boat captain, we had hired a couple of small cabin cruisers to take us to the estate, because you could only get to it by water on this huge lake, beautiful place.
Taking you out to the house that's on the cover of the book.
Yeah, that's correct. That's the estate. Yeah. That's the manor house. There are many other houses in the woods around it, guest houses, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And as we were walking across the grass up toward the house, he started goose-stepping with his right arm up in the air. And I said, what in the hell are you doing? And he said, I know who lived here. And I said, well, how do you know that? And he said, well, my father was the caretaker, and I lived here from the time I was a child. And I know who lived here, and he came up with his right arm in the party salute again, and then he marched off to his boat. So then in 2010, I went up to Cordoba province to visit a couple of spooky old hotels and talk to people there. And this trip, we went back to Cordoba. We spent time in Buenos Aires, of course, naturally, each time 1 week in Buenos Aires. And then up to Cordoba and talk to people in Buenos Aires and in Cordoba. And the older people we talked to, well, I told them what I was doing. They looked at me like I was nuts. Why are you searching about Hitler down here? Everybody knew he lived here. I said, oh, really? Okay, you guys knew it. But up in North America, we keep getting told that he shot himself in the head in the bunker. And so they, you know, the old people I talked to, they said, we knew Hitler lived here. And so did a ton of other guys, Martin Bormann, Eichmann, Mengele, and others that I had never even heard of before. And then I researched them again, Fridolin Guth, and then Ante Pavlik, the head of the Croatian side of the party. And well, we'll get into this later, but when when Ante Pavlik established himself in Buenos Aires, he helped 35,000 Croatian Nazis. I hate to use that word, but that's the easiest way for a description. He helped 35,000 get into Argentina.
That's a lot of folks.
With Perón.
Yeah. Now, talk about Juan Perón and Evita a little bit, and how they were staunchly anti-communist and very much pro-German, realizing that Germany was the only hope the world had to stave off the hordes of communism and all of its inglorious evil. And that's what Argentina fashioned itself by and on was Germany.
Yeah, they did fashion themselves after Germany quite a bit. And in the book, you'll see photos of good-looking German troops with good-looking German equipment taken in 1940 or 41, except they weren't Germans, they were Argentines, and they were in Argentina with all German uniforms, German equipment, German training.
Yeah.
The ties between Germany and South America, Argentina in particular, were very, very tight. And then, as you know, a couple of years ago, I went to that secret island off of Rio de Janeiro, about 1,000 kilometers out, called Trindade, not to be confused with Trinidad, that had an abundance of freshwater streams and creeks, and it had herds of pigs and goats, and this was right on the line down from Europe down towards Argentina. And so the black boats, tramp steamers and whatever was carrying human cargo, they'd stop there for fresh water and to resupply the meat larder. And you can only go there with the with the permission and with the assistance of the Brazilian Navy. And they were just super, gave me permission, took me out there on one of their ships, and I saw where the two different radio towers had been that the Germans built in 1939. And there's photos of that in the book, descriptions of it, and also on our website, too. People can go to sharkhunters.com, click on previous tours, and go to either the Argentine or the Brazilian trips and see all about it. And they were there. And there's an entire whole new story about World War II, south of the equator.
Yes, indeed. Now, when you were in Argentina during these trips, you met the one fellow who was a young boy on the estate who did the goose step and so forth. He obviously saw the two of them for years, potentially. Did he talk any further about it to you, or was he still not comfortable in doing that?
He wasn't that comfortable about it. When I looked like I was going to start talking to him, he just turned around and headed back to his boat. But then, you know, there was the fellow that owned the restaurant, and when I went there in 2008, he didn't speak English. I still don't speak Spanish, and he was trying to explain the specials of the day in his restaurant. He was a tall, blue-eyed, blonde guy.
Typical Spaniard.
About 80 years old.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't working. You know, he was saying it in Spanish. They were telling it to me in English, and it didn't sound like anything I wanted to eat. So I asked him in German. I said, "Bitte mein Herr, ich möchte eine Speisekarte mit englischer Schreiben. Please, sir, I'd like an English menu." Then he started speaking in German. And after about 2 minutes, I asked him in German. I said, "You speak good German. Why?" "I'm Swiss."
Yeah.
Right. And then before long, I had him singing some of the old songs, the Matrosenlied, which the U-boaters would sing when they were heading out to battle.
Uh-huh.
And then he went into the Panzerlied, the song of the armored divisions. I gave him thumbs up and smiled. He stood up, clicked his heels together, and put his right arm up in the air. And when I came back the next year, I had a group with me, and there were two guys who were hardcore right-wing from Germany, not World War II vets, but very hardcore right
mm-hmm.
wing.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And they had this old guy there until 2 o'clock in the morning singing the old military songs and the old party songs until 2 o'clock in the morning. He said, hey, look, guys, I gotta go to bed. Get out. There's no question. And that's where Erich Priebke was. He was a captain of the SS, the Hauptsturmfuhrer, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
And there were a lot of SS officers there. They had big parties, especially on the 20th of April, which was Hitler's birthday. And we've got pictures of some of those parties in the book. And they don't do it anymore because most of them are dead. But in that town there, Bariloche, there was a lot. And Bariloche at that time, well, it's 700 miles roughly southwest of Buenos Aires. And it's still way out in the country. But back in the 40s and early 50s, it was extremely remote.
You just didn't get there on a commuter flight, in other words.
No, and there wasn't any Autobahn going that way either.
Right.
You had to take a train. That's the only way you could get there back in those days. And it was a long, hard, and you wouldn't have any reason to go there. There was nothing there unless you were, you know, trying to hide out.
Okay, very good. We're talking with the remarkable Harry Cooper of SharkHunters.com, and this book is way, way overdue. And we'll tell you one of the reasons why we think that the lid has been kept on this for so long. Not that it's being voluntarily blown away by the survivors down there and their children and their grandchildren, but there's some very interesting reasons. The back cover of the book, you can see if you go to the top of Rents and click under the picture. Look at the back cover, and we'll talk about those two pictures of Hitler when we come back in just a couple of minutes with Harry. Okay, Harry and I are back, and we're talking about the new book, which will be shipping when, Harry, approximately?
2 weeks at the most, I think. We're just hung up. The text is there. They've got the text all laid out. But the cover, which is a beautiful cover from your friend David Dees, just a couple of minor changes. They have to come back a little bit because the text is too close to the edge and it'll disappear when they print it. So I'm just waiting for an updated one from David Dees, and we'll submit that. And I should have, from the time I submit that, it'll be about 4 days, I'll have a proofing copy, which I look through to make sure that the mm-hmm. density of the photos is correct. We don't have them washed out or looking all black and muddy. And then we just push the button and say, ship them. And we'll get a batch of them here, which we'll turn around and get out just as fast as they come in. They'll get out the day after they arrive mm-hmm. here.
People are already buying them.
Yeah, we've had to reprint the order blanks. We're running out of order blanks, and that's nice. A lot of our members, plus other people, they want to read this story because it's. We've been told all along that Hitler blew his brains out and Eva Braun took poison. And I know, you know, we've got this one former member who dropped his membership because everybody knows Hitler died fighting at the head of his troops. No, he didn't. If you believe the phony story, he died cowering in a basement, and that wasn't it either. But it's just, it's fact. He did not die in Berlin. And every so often somebody will say, well, the three SS men all saw it. Well, nobody saw anybody shoot themselves.
Correct.
And the three guys, Gunther, who we knew, Linge, and Kempke, they all gave differing stories. One said he heard the shot. Another said he didn't hear the shot, but he smelled gun smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And they told different times that they went in.
Right.
You know, it happened at this hour, three different versions of it, and three different guys told different stories about who went into the into Hitler's room, and you know, it was rehearsed. And according to one of our people, who's an expert, he believes it was done deliberately to appease people, but to let them realize, if they really looked into it, that it was a contrived story.
It's important to note also that just as American soldiers were extremely loyal in the war, the top-ranking members of the German military and the party were beyond loyal. I mean, they could keep a secret. And it's,
oh, God, yes.
It's and they'll take it with them with no questions asked.
Yeah, and some decades ago, the new German government passed a law saying that any oath that the World War II guys swore to the Hitler government no longer was in effect. In other words, they erased
right.
any oath.
Yeah.
But, you know, the government can try to erase an oath, but when a man, especially these old Germans, when they raise their hand and swear an oath, by God, they'll take it to the grave. And even
sure.
though the new government says, you can talk now, they ain't going to talk.
Right, right. Now, the reason I mentioned at the break that people have been quiet about this for so long can best be illustrated, I think, if you tell us the story of the waitress in Cordoba, and her original agreement to be interviewed by you and what happened. It's a very interesting story.
Catalina Gamarro. Well, first off, she was going to be interviewed by a friend of ours down there, Abel Basti, who's also an incredible researcher. And this was, I think 10 years ago in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And she was going to show pictures and everything, and then suddenly she said, nope.
She was going to show pictures of Hitler and Eva Braun.
That was what was the insinuation, yeah.
Sure.
But then she told Abel, no, they told me I cannot speak about it while the lady is alive, which led us to think that probably Eva Braun was still alive in 2004. She was born 1912, so that would have made her, 94 years old, I guess.
That's a little rusty. Yeah, well, that's easy to do.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, next month, Captain Hardigan, one of our members, the guy who sank the first ship in American waters, he turns 101.
Mm-hmm.
Lena Riefenstahl, the brilliant lady that gave us Triumph of the Will in the Olympics of 36, etc., she was over 101 when she died. My grandfather's sister was 104, so it's not impossible.
Right.
But anyhow, when we got there this time, this is quite a few years past 2004, and Catalina is in really failing health, so we couldn't talk to her, but my associate, Martin, did an interview with her a couple of years ago, which he put on tape, and or chip or whatever, whatever this modern stuff
is. Was it video, video or audio?
Video.
Uh-huh.
And so we quoted her directly in the book,
mm-hmm.
and she said that Hitler did not stay in the Eden Hotel, but he stayed in the annex. Now, the Eden Hotel is no longer its once glorious, glamorous self for various reasons. It just fell into disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
But the annex, which was a guest house about 200 yards away from the hotel itself, that's still up and being operated as a very nice hotel, and that's where I stayed. And boy, oh boy, if you let your imagination run, the fixtures are the same with the four and the crosses on the knobs with the ball on the end, you know, if you're old enough to remember that, and the big claw-footed bathtubs and the huge big double doors. And so that's where I stayed for a week. And
any others down there, Harry, that you talked to that alleged to have seen them? Were you able to get into anybody's psyche and confidence enough to get that kind of a statement from them?
Not that they actually laid eyeballs on them, because they were being very discreet, because they, I guess they didn't want to get captured and hanged like Eichmann.
Of course.
But there were those who like Catalina, she saw them, and like the boat captain,
yeah,
who knew them because he grew up on that estate in uh-huh. Patagonia.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I've mentioned to you before, in 1955, Bariloche was discovered as a sportsman's paradise with that huge big lake. In the summertime, they had great fishing, and in the wintertime, they had the Alps right, or the Andes right there for skiing. And we've seen pictures. I don't have copies of them, but we've seen pictures of Rudel, Colonel Rudel, and also Scorzini skiing there by Bariloche in the Andes. Well, you got to wonder, why would they be there? Why weren't they skiing back home in the Alps? Rudel, we know, because he and Adolf Galland and Werner Bombach,
mm-hmm.
among others, came over. These were some of the top pilots of the Luftwaffe.
Mm-hmm. Well, Galland was the general of the fighter forces.
That's correct, the jet fighters. He was head of
yeah.
JV-44, the Squadron of Experts.
Uh-huh.
And those three guys helped modernize the Argentine Air Force.
Mm.
And so Bombach was killed in a flight over there. He was training two Argentine pilots. They were flying an Avro Lancaster bomber. And I don't know who was at the controls, whether it was Bombach or whether it was one of his trainees, and they splashed it into the Rio de la Plata, and the plane sank, and Bombach couldn't get out of it, and he drowned.
Hmm.
But Galland was there, and Rudel, probably the greatest pilot ever.
Mm-hmm.
We've got pictures, which I've got on the rack to show this evening, if we have time. Rudel was there. He was
yeah.
best buddies with Juan Perón. He was there with his wife, who was just a gorgeous woman. And when the German soccer team came to Argentina sometime, I think in the 70s or 60s, they stayed at this huge big country club resort owned by the Argentine Air Force, and Rudel came there to that country club to hang out with the soccer team. That's also the place where Isabelita, was held under house arrest. This was Perón's third wife, and she was the vice president. And when he died, Isabelita became president of Argentina. And she got overthrown a couple of years later in a bloodless coup, and she was held under house arrest, but not in her house. She was held there at this Air Force base. I saw a lot of stuff this time around.
Yeah, I bet you did. How many of the old-timers are still there?
Oh, darn few. Darn mm-hmm. few, because the clock is ticking.
Yeah, yeah.
And the few that are there after... After Pribke got grabbed,
yeah,
the rest of them pretty well went undercover.
I would think. The children and grandchildren are there. One would imagine that the families are
right.
certainly well-versed in the history of what happened after the war.
Oh, yeah. And when Catalina said they told me I can't speak about it, they refers to Die Spinne, which means the spider.
Uh-huh.
And which we know more popularly as Odessa.
Correct.
And it's the children and the sons and the grandsons
mm-hmm.
that are still running it.
Mm-hmm.
And I met one a couple of years ago when I was in Cordova. His grandfather was an adjutant, a generalleutnant, a lieutenant general, an adjutant under Kurt Panzermeier, the great Panzer general. So the old ways are still in keeping down there. And when we drove from Cordova City to Miramar, which is a million miles away from nothing, we had to drive 3 or 4 hours through the Pampas, and the windshield wipers on our rental car, the blades weren't very good, and all of a sudden there's this wide spot in a road where there's a big building, and you could There's a diner and a gas station and a repair shop and an auto parts place. So we pulled in to have something to eat and to buy new wiper blades. And here comes all these little kids, 5, 6, 7 years old, all blue-eyed, blonde-haired kids running through the station, and their blonde, blue-eyed mother chasing them.
Very interesting. Yeah, fascinating. Now, you've got, when you click on the page to buy the book, and I hope all of you do, it's only $25, and this really will open the door to a part of history that has been welded shut by the powers that be for reasons I tried to outline at the beginning of the program. This was a technology deal. Hitler was allowed to live out his life with his wife and all the other Germans who went there in exchange for the brilliant German technology. Fair trade. Fair trade. The Americans weren't about to let it get into the hands of the Russians, so they made the deal. And that deal apparently held up very well. There's a official memorandum, United States government, FBI, September 7, 1945. Very interesting, from an agent in Los Angeles. Some of it's redacted, but it talks about the landing in Argentina, and I'm going to read this real quickly if I can. I got my magnifying glass. It's a little tough to read.
Yeah.
The first submarine reportedly docked at approximately 11 at night, and the second submarine about 2 hours later. Hitler was reported to have been aboard the second submarine, and with a doctor and something were waiting for the group. Okay. Let's see. Several other members in, or about 50 persons, came ashore from the submarine. Pack horses were waiting and for the group, and at daylight, an all-day trip inland toward the foothills of the southern Andes started. And at dusk, the party arrived at the ranch where Hitler and his party are now in hiding. And this is, again, say, September 1945. This FBI report, they had identified Hitler as hiding in the Andes, in the foothills, on FBI documentation. So,
right, that was September, which is dead of winter in Argentina, and the ranch is the Estancia San Ramon. We visited there in 2008.
And that wasn't his final destination, of course.
Right.
He was headed toward a beautiful estate with outhouses, guest houses, built by the Mercedes family, I guess. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the place was built in the closing moments of the war. Now, Admiral Dönitz had been overheard to say in 1944, Admiral Dönitz said, "We have found an impregnable Shangri-La for the Führer." And right about that time, they began building this place. It's called Inalco, and built with Mercedes money, allegedly. And the place wasn't quite ready when they got there. Plus, it was the dead of winter, and they could get as far as the Estancia San Ramon, but it was another 20 or 30 miles, I guess, to Bariloche, and they had to wait until the spring thaw until they could get to the new estate. And nobody seems to know who owns the place. It's up for sale, we understand, for 40 million Yankee dollars, which is an incredible fortune because the Argentine peso is still devaluating. It's 10 to 1 now, I think. It's 8 to 1 is the official, and you can get about 12 to 1 from the black market.
Now, so, you were in the building, in the main building, in the house, the estate, and how did it look inside? What was your feeling of it? There was, and I've seen the pictures, and there are more pictures on sharkhunters.com of this. There is an enormous, beautiful dining table, big table.
The thing was, it was huge. Must have taken, you know, half a dozen men and a donkey to pick it up, because that thing, solid wood, I'm guessing oak. I don't know. I'm not an expert on that.
Yeah.
But the place was beautiful, and the wooden beds, And the cooking equipment was still there. The place hadn't been lived in a long time. but fortunately, spending a short time when I lived in Chicago, short time working for the mafia, I learned how to pick locks. So I let myself into the building.
Oh, that's how you got in. Uh-huh.
Well, the sign said, Harry is welcome. It says, no pesar, which I know means Harry is welcome.
Harry is welcome. Yeah,
the same as in Germany, it's Ein Gang verboten, which means Harry is welcome.
Shark hunters, too.
Yeah, that's it. Shark hunters are welcome. So, now that, you know, obviously it means no pesar means no trespassing, but that generally means there's something there I want to see.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, now there's also a map here on the left side, which we can look at. We're looking at the page you go to order the book, and we're going to look at a whole bunch of photographs just after the top of the hour here. The map on the left side is of what? What are we looking at?
Now you caught me. Is that one of the pictures I have on the array?
Yeah, no, it's on the order book page. You've got the FBI document, and you've got to the left of it, a map, a hand-drawn map. Looks like inlets and so forth.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, it's one of them says Clarence. There's a Clarence something. That is, now, in 1915, when the cruiser Dresden escaped and was the only part of Admiral Graffunch Bay's cruiser squadron to live through the Falklands battle with the British, he went through the Straits of Magellan, and they were finding hidden harbors where they could stick submarines or ships or whatever, and these are, we've got several hand-drawn maps that came from a source in Germany that showed where all these places were. And then in 1938, they sent the Linien ship, the line ship, Schleswig-Holstein through there to do it again. To update the charts, and that's where those charts came from. We've got several more charts in the book, three charts like that, I think, and several more on the website.
Where did the two submarines land that the FBI memo talks about?
We are 99.5% sure it was Bahia Blanco.
Which is?
It's down south of Mar de la Plata.
Okay.
It's in that area because one of our people, we called her Agent Nightingale, but she's now passed away, so I can say that was my dear friend Ingrid Scharfenberg. She was in very, very tight contact with a lot of the old guys, and she's the one who told me that the German government came ashore at Bahia Blanca. And I said, what do you mean the German government? Do you mean Martin Bormann? She says, no, the only German government is Adolf Hitler. But they were, the boats had been landing all through the war down in Golfo San Martin. No, St. Matthew, however you say that. Golfo San Matias. And way up in the corner, the northwestern corner of the Golfo San Matias is a little cove called Caleta de los Loros, the Parrot Cove. And there was a little town there, San Antonio Oeste. And in that town was a building owned by the Lausanne Wool Company. And Lausanne Wool Company was all over Argentina with their headquarters in Buenos Aires, German-owned company, and all the spies went through there. And so that's where submarines, and they had this two-masted yawl rigged 90-ton boat that went in and out of there several times under a captain by the name of Heinrich Garbers, Kapitän Leutnant Heinrich Garbers, who was awarded the Knight's Cross, and you look at his history, and it's blank. Nobody knows who he was, what he did, or why he got the Knight's Cross, but this is why. And he was overheard in a conversation with Bormann, excuse me, right around the time Dönitz said we had found this Shangri-La for the Führer. Garbers was being debriefed by Bormann, and he said how easy it was to get in and out of there with the wooden ship because there was, you know, radar is not going to catch it. And Bormann asked, could he get important people in and out. And Garbus told him, sure, not a problem.
Okay, so the two submarines that docked, one of them allegedly carrying Hitler and obviously the uppermost level, at least part of it, of the German government, and they disembarked there. The story about the American DC-4s, I do believe to be accurate, judging from the man who related the story to my friend. He's, again, in his mid-90s, a P-51 hero pilot of the war in Europe, and was kept on to fly these DC-4s, which went back and forth, long-range fuel tanks, carrying people, material, and all kinds of things. So it makes sense.
Yeah, it does, because there had to be a way to get... And there was a ton of people came out of there, and they just kind of assimilated, and they had bridge posts, we'll call them, in Buenos Aires to help get them assimilated, except for a few people like Eichmann and Fridolin Guth and one or two other guys who were not wealthy and could not afford to buy protection, which is one reason why Eichmann was finally grabbed.
He was a
factory worker, and at first he worked in a place called FV, like Frank Victor. He worked on the line, and they made accessories for toilets. Then, for whatever reason, he left that job and went to work for a place called Orbis, which was owned by a guy named Roberto Merteg, who was a good buddy of Perón. But that apparently didn't help Eichmann, because he worked there for a certain number of years, and then he left and he went to work for Mercedes. But the Mercedes plant is way, way, way out of the city, and he had to ride a bus 3 hours each way. And he'd get home about 9 o'clock at night. And his house, you'll see a picture of it there, is only about 20 foot by 20 foot. He and his two sons had built it, and we saw the place where the Mossad lay in ambush to grab him when he got off the bus. So he didn't have a lot of money. The other guys, Mengele and some of the other hierarchy, they had friends.
Yeah, Mengele died in 1979, supposedly. That's the official version. We don't know.
Yeah, he was afraid of water, and yet he died while he was swimming.
Yeah.
One of our members, we call him Agent Rembrandt. He's retired. He worked for the Dutch Secret Service, and he said his boss sat down for an interview with Mengele and taped the interview 1 year after Mengele allegedly died.
Okay, there you go.
He was going to get me a copy of that
Staging a death is an old trick. Harry, hold on if you would. We have to come back after the break and continue our conversation. We're going to look at a lot of pictures. Click on the back cover of the book. Look at those two photographs up there. We'll talk about those as we continue in just a couple of minutes. The book, Hitler in Argentina, by Harry Cooper, available now. Okay, here we are, hour number two, a world exclusive brought to you by Rents.com and through the courtesy of Harry Cooper, who has really turned this whole story loose, finally. With as much documentation as we have now, perhaps in a couple of years there'll be more, and a second edition can come out, but right now this book is loaded. Don Angel, 100 and how many pages of single-space typewritten?
It was a 114-page letter he sent us.
Right. All right. Well,
typewritten and single-spaced.
He was in the bunker, correct?
Yes, he was in the bunker for the last 3 months, and he saw Hitler forcibly drugged under orders of Martin Bormann, the same for Eva Braun, and removed from the bunker. And then he escaped with quite an entourage a few days later and made it down to... a place in Bavaria called Rottach am Egern, where thousands of people were headed. And according to Don Angel, which you'll read in the book, somebody put a number on the side of their car, probably in shoe polish, and that would tell them where they were supposed to go to congregate and get their directions to go further on. And he made his way back to Spain, and then eventually over working for the Reich in Mexico City, and then down where he met with Hitler in 1952. And then in 1958, he went down to meet with Martin Bormann. And some of the letters he wrote to me are also in the book with the translations, and it's very interesting.
I would say. So he met face-to-face with Hitler in 1952. Hitler lived in Bariloche with Eva Braun until 1955.
Right. In his letter and in the book, Don Angel said it was Antarctica. And I'm not sold on that. I think it was deliberate disinformation, because the way he described the compound where he landed, it pretty well fits the compound at Bariloche, the place called Inalco.
Mm-hmm. Which you can buy for $40 million today if you happen to have that kind of
right.
money. It's a gorgeous
it's got
place.
The big estate building, plus a lot of outbuildings, the power building, the cooking building, the heating building, and a lot of acreage. So $40 million probably is worth it, except I'm waiting for Obama to send me my money, and then maybe I'll have $40
million. Yeah, well, he's got to spend money on killing people and drones and Obamacare first. So
yeah.
I'm getting lying.
So I guess I'm not getting my money from him.
Probably not.
Bummer.
Okay, let's... Let's take a look at some pictures now. If you want to go to guests at Rents and take a look, you'll see Harry Cooper's name, and right under that, you can find photos. Click on photos and pull them up. And here we go. All right, Harry, let's step off. Now, remember, the book is being published now and printed. It'll be shipping in 2 weeks. David Dees did the artwork. Harry Cooper.
Beautiful cover.
Stunning cover. This book is again going to hopefully, it certainly will be read by the elite. We hope it'll sell a lot. We hope you'll make some noise about it on our behalf as well. It's time the truth comes out. And this is as close to the truth as we can get right now. When you understand that the American government was flying Germans and wealth and papers and documents to Argentina in DC-4 as long-range fuel tanks, hundreds of flights potentially, we don't even know how many. You have to figure out that there was a deal made. No question about it, none. All right, first picture, sunrise.
Yeah, okay, this is just a fluff picture. This is out of my hotel. I'm way up top of the Navy Hotel. It's a beautiful city.
This is your,
picture
your trip
number two.
Just recently, correct?
Oh, yeah, just a couple of weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, all right.
Yeah.
All right.
And photo number two, you'll notice there's Evita.
Yeah.
On the side of that building. Now, there's other pictures of Evita on the other sides of the building. You know, 15 or 20 years ago, it was a crime to even say the name Perón. Now, the Peronistas are the biggest party, political party. But remember this building, because we'll get back to it later.
Okay.
Photo three and four, they gave me a tour of a shipyard, and they're building other submarines there. I could not take photos, but this one was in the Falkland-Malvinas War. And this one, it's a German 205 or 206 class submarine. It penetrated the Royal Navy screen and got in and fired torpedoes and hit several ships. But unfortunately for them, the torpedoes were duds, and all you got was boink. So,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's going to be a memorial on display, so that's why I could take the pictures of it. And it had a different propeller. The new boats use a seven-bladed propeller. They call it the seven-bladed man chopper. Mm-hmm. This guy only has a five-bladed propeller. So
this is a German design, but updated after the war and built in Argentina.
Built in Argentina. They're building under license.
Right, got it. Okay.
Item five, this is an interesting thing. This is a restaurant not far from my hotel. It's called the ABC Restaurant. It's been in business since the 1920s. This was a favorite spot for Eichmann and Mengele to meet for lunch. So we met there for lunch, too, my associate Martin and I. And it looked inside. It looks exactly like that Italian restaurant in The Godfather where Michael shot the crooked cop and the Turk.
Red and white checkered tablecloths?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Looked exactly like it. Okay,
well,
then we move on.
There's a piece of history stuck between two large, newer buildings.
And so, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of cute.
I probably shouldn't say this, but hygiene was not one of their strong suits. We watched a waiter go over to a table where the people had just left. He picked up their bread plate, and it wasn't really too bad off. He took the water glass and splashed a little of the water onto the plate, took the guy's napkin and wiped the bread plate clean and stuck it on another table.
Something wrong with that, Harry?
Hey, I'm used to living out in the wild. That doesn't bother me, but many people would would have a problem with it.
All right.
There were two beautiful Irish girls in there, and they came over to our table. They'd only finished half their bottle of wine, and so they asked if, they picked up that we were speaking English, Martina and myself, and they gave us a half a bottle of wine and said they had to get back to wherever they were going, and they didn't have time to finish the wine. Well, nice restaurant.
Okay. Picture number six, a very handsome color picture of one of the great heroes on both sides of the war. He is the Germans' superior.
Adolf Galland.
General of the German fighter forces, and with JB-44,
right,
flew the twin jet Messerschmitt. He said when he first took off in that plane, he said it felt like angels were pushing it.
Yeah, I remember that quote. And he was a member of Shark Hunters until he died. Under the knife, he was going open-heart surgery, and I guess it didn't go well. The guy in number seven, probably the greatest pilot of all time. They had to create a special medal for him, the Knight's Cross with oak leaf, swords, and diamonds in gold. That's Hans Ulrich Rudel. And you look down at picture 8, 9, and 10, there's Rudel and his wife with Perron. They're best buddies there. And Rudel pretty well had his run of Argentina. He helped rebuild the Argentine Air Force. And he finally returned to Germany, and I guess he fell out of favor with the new politically correct government, and so he could not be buried in the big church cemetery in a big city, so they buried him in a tiny little church cemetery about an hour out of Nuremberg. And whenever I have a group over there, we go to his grave, and we place a big wreath of flowers on his grave, because he was a great pilot, greatest probably ever.
Great German patriot. He flew Stuka.
Right. Most of his time he flew a Stuka, but then when the Allies were closing the ring around Germany, they gave him a fighter. I think it was a Focke Wulf FW-190.
Mm-hmm.
And he became an ace. He shot down seven airplanes. And, he only had one leg.
Yeah, he crashed, I believe, wasn't it? And lost a leg?
I'm not sure on that, but
shot
he crashed
plane
several
out.
Times. He got shot down several times.
The Stuka was a ground support, like an A-7 today. It would come out
and support. It was a dive bomber.
Take out tanks and so forth.
And he sank a battleship and many other ships, and he destroyed God knows how many trucks, and he also destroyed more than 500 Russian tanks.
The Germans literally could not kill the Russian military fast enough. They were just overrun. It's just they were too
many. They just had an overabundance of people, and Stalin didn't mind wasting a million here and a million there because he had 10 million more behind him.
Exactly. And speaking behind them, if a Soviet soldier turned around, he was shot by the commissar who was making sure that nobody retreated.
Yeah, that's a real incentive to keep moving forward, isn't it?
Yeah, especially when you're crawling over the bodies of your comrades and friends.
Right.
Okay.
You had to do that to pick up a weapon because a lot of them didn't even have weapons. They had to pick up a weapon from a guy that got shot.
That's exactly correct.
That's
okay. So
hell of an incentive.
Yeah. Picture number eight, on the left, smiling and shaking hands with the gray hair, is
Rudel.
And the right of him is Perón.
That's correct.
And to the right of him,
that's his wife. That's
Evita.
No, not Evita.
Oh,
Evita
that's
was shorter.
That's Rudel's wife.
Rudel's wife.
Yeah.
Then
stunning.
At number nine, I think you see Evita on the left and then Rudel's wife. Then at number 10, I think that's Evita in between the two of them. I think.
Stunning pictures from history. Just remarkable.
And who would have known?
Yeah.
And then you look at photo number 11. We know who that is, Martin Bormann. And number 12, that's the Plaza Hotel, which was the most upscale hotel in Buenos Aires at the time, and even maybe today. And so we knew Bormann had stayed there for 2 years after he got to Argentina with two young women. And I went to the front desk, the lady there, Senora Rodriguez, and she spoke perfect English. I introduced myself, told her what I was doing, and I said, I'm trying to check out the story that Martin Bormann lived here in the plaza. Now, here we are in Argentina. Who the hell is Martin Bormann? She never batted an eye. She said, oh, yeah, he stayed in room 470, the presidential suite. Oh, bingo. I said, you know this? She says, yeah, everybody here knows it. Uh-huh. And I said, oh, well, he stayed here with two young women. And she got all blushed, and she says, I don't know about that. So, but she just confirmed, you know, matter-of-factly, everybody here knew Bormann lived in the plaza for a couple of years after the war.
He wasn't trying to hide too energetically.
No, from what our research found, he and Perón opened several joint bank accounts using their own names.
That's pretty brazen. The deal had been struck, so I guess they didn't have to worry.
Right.
In their minds.
And then come 1947, Perón suddenly was an incredibly wealthy man. And he was no longer a colonel. He was a general. He was president of Argentina, and nobody was going to extradite his friends. Let's see, 13 and 14, we just threw these in. We had lunch at the Deutsche Club, and these German emblems are all around the club. Strangely, nobody there spoke German. I was trying to find somebody to speak German with. They didn't speak German. Photo 15. You can see the swastikas in that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that was done deliberately or if that was just a clever design, but those are all over that train station by the thousands.
There's no coincidences.
Yeah, and they had a nice restaurant in that train station, too. So then we move on to 16 and 17.
Pictures 16 and 17.
About, yeah, 16 and 17.
These must have been in Munich or Nuremberg or somewhere.
Well, you know, we had rallies like this in Madison Square Garden in New York.
We did. I was going to mention that. And some of the speakers there, and you can see the speeches.
Right.
Absolutely amazing. Charles Lindbergh.
And some others.
Charles Lindbergh gave an absolutely great speech at one of these rallies. This was the German-American Bund. People who recognized
it. This was not shot in Madison Square Garden. This was shot in Luna Park, which was about six blocks from my hotel in Buenos Aires. And you see in picture 18, that's what it looks like today, Luna Park. And now they have, rock stars like that idiot Justin Bieber and many others. They also have boxing matches there, but it was closed because there was nothing going on.
Okay, now let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
This is a huge rally. What year would this rally have been? Do we know?
This particular one, I think, was in 38.
Okay.
They had their biggest rally there was to celebrate the Anschluss, the connection of Germany and Austria.
Uh-huh. Do remember, folks, that the same kind of rallies occurred here in the United States in the late 30s?
Yep.
Okay.
So,
there it is today. Kind of crummy looking compared to what it was. Looks like it has a new modern face
on it. Yeah, maintenance has gone off a little bit. Coca-Cola has signs all over Luna Park now. I guess they help finance it or something, but we wanted to go inside to take a look, and nobody was there except the security guard, and my associate Martin convinced the guy I was a big-time rock star promoter from the United States, so he let us in, and we went all through the place. There was nothing there, just a big empty stadium, but I'm a big rock star promoter now, according to these guys.
Sounds right to me. Okay, whatever it takes, you get in where you need to get in.
Yeah, well, you got to be creative. How's that?
You are that. Now, number 19?
Now, this is really interesting. You know who that is. That's Eichmann.
Mm-hmm.
And I told you about where he worked and everything.
Yes.
Photo number 20 in that corner, that's where the Mossad guys ambushed him. They were hiding up on the railroad embankment, and when the bus stopped and Eichmann got out, they ran over, boom.
And remember, he was working in a factory 3 hours
Mercedes.
Each way. Mercedes
right.
factory, and had a 20 by 20 foot house. That was it. And tipped off somehow, but they went in to get him, and they got him.
They got him. And photo 21, this is the lot on Garibaldi Street where Eichmann's house had stood. I think there was a book. I've never seen it, but I think there was a book called The House on Garibaldi Street, which is about him.
Demolished by the politically correct boys?
Demolished by somebody. Uh-huh. And I was shooting through a chain-link fence. Uh-huh. You can't get onto the property. I'm guessing, and that's all it is, I'm guessing uh-huh. they want to make sure that it's not turned into a shrine, because there's a very large, how do I say this properly, a large right-wing group there, neo-Nazis.
Okay.
And every year on the anniversary of the loss of the battleship Graf Spee, they march by the hundreds to the cemetery where Langsdorff's body is buried. So I guess they want to make sure that this is not a shrine. But from what I understand from Martin, you don't come into this neighborhood at night. And during the daytime, you better not linger too long or somebody's going to come and rob you.
All right.
It was a real seedy neighborhood.
Got it. Number 22.
To make extra money, Eichmann was selling fruit juices there at the marina on the weekend.
Huh.
And that's the Rio de la Plata out there by the yacht yard.
Mm-hmm.
And here, number 23, this was Francisco's tailor shop. He made all of Eichmann's suits. Remember, back in those days, you didn't buy suits off the rack from Walmart.
No.
And Francisco's two kids played with Eichmann's two sons when they were little kids. But Eichmann's sons referred to Eichmann as their uncle rather than their father, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And they said their father was killed in the war. The younger son said that, and he said this quite often, he said that they had lived in the Vatican for a while during their trip through Europe, and that they had met the Pope.
The rat line.
Yeah, so the Catholic Church was very helpful to the guys getting out at that time.
Right.
And Francisco said he was proud that Eichmann wore his suit when he was in the glass booth.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Bitter humor there.
Yeah, he talked freely, but he wouldn't let me film. I had to keep the camera off.
Okay.
So what I got was out of memory. Now, 24, that is Eichmann's house. You see, it's pretty damn small.
Damn small.
Yeah, about 20 by 20, I'm guessing.
But this is after the war, he's hanging out a flag with a swastika on?
This was after Eichmann got grabbed. His older son went a little over the edge, and he hoisted the swastika flag alongside the Argentine flag. He didn't do this. You know, he was trying to stay undercover, but then after he was grabbed, the son was really, I think he went over the edge a little bit, as you see in photo 25. That's his oldest son after his father was grabbed. Now, both of Eichmann's sons still live in Buenos Aires, but they changed their names, changed their identities, and it would be incredibly hard to find them. And even if you did find them, I'm guessing you would be told hit the trail.
So those are both of his sons, 25 and 27?
Well, it's the same son in 25 and 27, or 24 and 25.
Okay.
Page 20, or photo 24 and 25.
All right. And who's number 27?
27. That's Mengele.
Ah.
Joseph Mengele.
Okay.
The so-called Angel of Auschwitz.
Back during the war, I assume?
Yeah. He was at Auschwitz. And he was conducting experiments, allegedly. I guess he was. But he had money when he hit Buenos Aires, and he could buy friends. Now, you look at the photo 28.
Right.
That's a house owned by a very wealthy and well-connected Argentinian named Gerhard Malbrank.
Mm-hmm.
And Malbrank picked up Mengele from his hotel. Mengele was only in Buenos Aires a couple of days. And Malbrank picked him up and brought him over to live. And you look at the front porch with that yellow circle around it, and then looked at photo 29, and there's Mengele standing right in that spot with Malbrank's cat.
How interesting.
Yeah, now in
That's a cat? That's a Scotty dog.
Okay, that's a bad picture. Sorry, it's a Scotty dog.
Maybe it is a scat. No, it is a cat. It's a Persian.
Whatever the hell it is.
It's a Persian cat. Now, he's got a mustache there, but you can see the front teeth with the infamous gap in them.
Yep.
And that's him. I wonder who took that
picture. And we show all these houses that we're going to talk about here, Mengele's houses, Perón's houses, other houses, and we list their street address.
All right. So people can go
down there
and see.
I'm told I might get in trouble over that, but I hope not.
All
incidentally,
right.
If your listeners want a copy of our monthly magazine, they should just send an email to sharkhunters@earthlink.net and say they want a free copy, and we'll email it right off to them.
Really? Oh, that's a nice offer. It's a wonderful magazine. All right. This is what you get if you join Shark Hunters every month. Okay. We'll come right back and look at pictures number 30 and 31 and so forth as we move through with Harry.
Gotcha.
Hang on.
Yes, sir.
Okay, history comes alive for you with Harry Cooper's new book, Hitler in Argentina. This is the book. Forget the other recent ripoffs. This is the book that will tell you the story. From Don Angel, the secret agent who was in the bunker for 3 months before the end, he got out. This is the story of people who were down there who had interactions with him and knew exactly what was going on, and they all did. And if you don't believe they can keep a secret, then you're not thinking. They can keep a secret easily, these people, and did. And took it to the grave with them. This was their country, their leader. They knew the evil on the planet was Soviet Zionist Bolshevism. They knew these were a godless race of people, political race at least. And to this day, Russia absolutely despises the Bolshevik Zionist Jews. They know that in 1917... and again in 1992, it was the Zionist Jews who destroyed their country and their people. And they were basically responsible for killing 65 to 70 million of them during the Stalin era. So they don't forget the Russians. They know. All right, number 30 in our picture parade with Harry Cooper.
Number 30, that's Mengele with the mustache in the Malbrank's house. And that's Malbrank next to him, and that's Malbrank's 10-year-old daughter that looks very uncomfortable sitting on Mengele's lap. I'm not going to read anything into that picture. Number 32 and 33, those two very, very upscale homes were kind of backyard, touching each other's backyard. 32...
Who's number 30? Picture number 31, Harry, please. An older lady.
31. There is no 31.
I've got a 31. It's a lady in a hat, black and white photo.
Oh, okay. Okay,
she's got
that
a big
was,
coat on of some
yeah,
kind.
Yeah, she
dark
was
coat.
Mengele's sister-in-law.
Okay.
And her husband got killed. That was Mengele's brother, and so he married her.
Well, that's
the least
he could
do. I didn't know I sent that along. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. Okay.
So 32 and 33, like I say, those two upscale homes, really upscale, were kind of backyard to backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And number 32 was one of Mengele's houses. He owned three.
Mm-hmm.
And number 33 was Perón's presidential palace after he came back into power. And right above the number 33 is the balcony where he and Isabelita would stand and make speeches.
Picture number 33?
Yeah.
Huh. Doesn't look big enough.
Oh, it's a lot bigger than what the picture shows.
Okay. All right. Very good.
We tried... We tried to get inside for a tour, but the new owner said, no, hit the trail. Okay, 34, that's that guy, Ante Pavlik, I was talking about.
Oh, yeah.
He was the Croatian leader, and he was hardcore. And even after Germany surrendered, he urged his people to keep fighting.
Yeah,
so he ultimately came over to Argentina.
Uh-huh.
And he was just a poor guy. He was a bricklayer. And then through a friend, he met Perón and became a very successful building contractor.
Uh-huh.
He built many of the skyscrapers in Buenos Aires,
oh,
including photo number 2, the one that had Evita stuck,
oh,
to,
yes,
the side of the building.
Got it.
And that was him.
Yeah, on the top of the building, a number of radio and television transmitters, you can see.
Righto. And I was taking pictures of the house he owned over the fence, and the lady came out to ask what the hell was this Yankee doing, taking pictures. Very nice lady, Monica. She was born and raised in Germany, came over to Argentina when she was a young girl,
mm-hmm,
and married an attorney. She's 54.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told her what I was doing, and she says, oh, we knew Hitler lived in Argentina. What's the big story? She was one of them that said that. And she was telling us about Antipavlik and all the parties he threw.
Right.
And she says, hey, the lady across the street knew him, an old lady. And so the old lady was sitting in her window, and we went over, and Monica started talking to her in Spanish, and the old lady was about to start saying something, and the old lady's daughter come up and slammed the window shut, and that was the end of that one. But then Monica pointed us to the corner,
uh-huh,
and photo number 35, when Pavlik came home from work one day, a Yugoslavian secret police hitman was waiting for him in the bushes, and when he got off the bus, he shot Pavlik twice in the back. Didn't kill him, and the whole story's in the book, of course, but Pavlik was in the hospital in Buenos Aires, and Perón got deposed again, and so Perón had opposed extraditing Pavlik back to Europe, and so now the new Argentine government says, yeah, we'll extradite him, we'll send him there. Well, Pavlik checked himself out of the hospital, went to Chile and another South American country, and then went over to Spain,
mm-hmm,
where he checked himself into the German hospital in Spain, and 2 years after he was shot in the back, he finally died in the hospital over there.
Mm.
And there's a whole lot more on our website and also in this book. So now we
number 36.
Fly off to,
wanna
say again?
Take a look at number 36.
36. We've gone off to Cordoba province now, and that's the Hotel Eden, which Cordoba City and La Falda, where this hotel is, that's about 400 miles northwest of Buenos Aires, and again, in the war years and for some time afterwards, this was really seriously remote. And prior to the war, people would come by the hundreds and sit in the courtyard because the Eichhorn family, great supporters of Hitler, they would pipe in Hitler's speeches from overseas. They were the only place in for hundreds of miles around that could get the overseas transmissions, and they would broadcast them, and people would sit there and listen to them. This is where Catalina Gamarro worked. And the next photo, 37, that's the annex where Hitler and Eva Braun stayed when they came there. They didn't stay at a main hotel. They stayed. Not a very good picture. We've got more pictures in the book and on the website. It's a beautiful place, and when we go back next January, we're going to stay there again, and if anybody's interested in joining us in January of 2015, just send me an email and say, hey, put me on the list for information when it comes out. No obligation. We'll just send you the information.
Okay.
Sharkhunters@earthlink.net. Now, the Eichhorn family were very staunch Hitler supporters,
mm-hmm,
and they sent a lot of money to Hitler when he was in his political rise.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next thing is, in my opinion, is the pièce de résistance of the whole shooting match, the secret compound.
Okay, that's picture number 38.
Right.
Start with 38.
You're
going
down.
Look way down that road, straight
way
ahead.
Way down.
And you see a dark opening. Okay.
Yep. Like Alice going through the tunnel.
Yeah.
But to find this place, you're going down a modern four-lane highway, and you have to know where to look for it. There's just a little slit in the trees. We knew where it was, and we blew past it. We had to come back. So when you come in, photo 38, that's an abandoned place now, but that was the security checkpoint. Then
that building.
You go,
okay.
Say again?
That building was the security checkpoint. Okay.
That was the first one.
All right. Now, this is where German expats had to go to get new identities, plastic surgery, relocated, and all the rest of it.
And training.
Yeah.
So you go down the road, maybe half a mile, and there, picture 39, you see the tunnel. And picture 40, that's the way it looked like back in the 30s and 40s.
That's an extraordinary picture. Look at that.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. That came from my associate, Martin.
It's amazing.
So when you go through the tunnel, then you're in the midst of the jungle. You're out in the woods, mm-hmm. and you drive down this single-lane dirt road at least a mile, if not maybe more, through the densely forested area. And that yellow arrow points to just a hole in the trees where you keep on going. And then we pass quite a few signs that say shark hunters are welcome, you know, no pets.
Understand,
are.
Yeah.
Yeah, and 42, once you get to the end of this road, all of a sudden the whole compound opens up to you. And photo 42, that's the latrines and the shower. And the sign says Baños Caldera, which I think means hot water.
Hot baths.
Hot bath, okay. Well, that's... My Spanish is pretty rotten.
Agua is water. Baños
is
bath.
Okay, so Baños Caliente is hot baths.
Yeah.
Okay.
43,
they've still got all these like picnic tables.
How amazing. This facility obviously encompassed, 5-10 acres, something like that?
Oh, every bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
There was even parts of it we didn't even get to.
Mm-hmm.
But... the caretaker told us that the troops would, or the people would drill over on the grinder just to the right of that big oak tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then into the woods there, they had weapons training in the woods.
Now, these are the actual German soldiers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So now we flip to...
We got to remember that General Patton kept two full divisions of SS ready after the surrender. He wanted to go against the Bolshevik Zionist Jews... Soviets and kicked their butts all the way out of Soviet Russia and free Russia. He wanted them gone. He knew who the enemy was. He knew.
He kind of fell out of power there.
Well, he fell
out of favor. That plus he kept asking what happened to the $2 billion worth of gold that disappeared out of the Reichsbank.
Exactly.
Well, that's what helped him.
He killed him for his efforts.
Yeah, that's what helped him get whacked.
He knew. He knew what was going on. He understood, Patton.
Worse yet, he knew, but he talked.
Unfortunately
Knowing,
for
I
him.
Guess they could live with, but when you're talking too much, you get whacked, just like my friend Jörg Haider in Austria, but that's another whole story.
Well, we'll tell that story next visit, maybe.
Yeah.
That's an important
one. I've got a bunch. I'm still waiting for the last one-third of the story to come in, but we can email back and
picture
forth.
Number, good, we will. Picture number 44.
44, that's a swimming pool. It's two or three times the size of a... an Olympic pool, and look at all the little cabanas. Let your imagination run. Who changed their suits there?
Yeah.
And then we go down past the pool, and there's that little building, number 45, and the German engineers routed a small amount of the river through a concrete channel that ran underneath this building and turned a big paddle wheel, which turned a generator, which gave them all their electric power.
Well,
pretty clever.
German ingenuity.
Yeah,
and,
Deutsches Qualitäts.
Yep. All right, number 46.
46, just you have to wonder who sat on this old stone bench.
Yeah.
And 47 and 48, you know, we hear about the godless Nazis. This was a shrine. It's you go down into this slit they built, and there's the shrine still there. And they've got a natural spring running water through it.
This is a Christian shrine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they're supposed to be godless Nazis, remember?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
What about the godless Soviets? This is ridiculous, of course.
Well, they're the good guys. They won, see?
Yeah, right.
The good guys won, and the bad
Uncle
guys
Joe.
Lost. Our
Uncle
government
Joe.
Says so.
Biggest butcher, biggest known butcher in human history, Joseph Stalin, never gets any press. Except the UK press about every week pulls out an evil Nazi story. They keep kicking dead horse. They'll do that forever.
So, 49, that's the sink in the Banos caldera, and that's me shooting the picture. Number 50 is the showers. I guess they still work. I didn't want to try them, but in 51, you see the sink. The water does work.
Who owns this facility now?
I don't know.
Privately owned? State owned?
It's privately owned now. And the caretaker, we had to bend the truth a little bit for him. We told him that I was a big-time movie producer, and I was looking for a place to rent for a week to do a war movie.
Harry. That's right. Okay. Good for you.
Number 52, that's the former headquarters building in the orderly room. And there's a bunch more photos on the site and in the book, but I didn't want to jam you up with too many photos. 53, that's the file you read, FBI file. 54, that's a letter from Adolf Hitler to Ida Eichhorn before the war, thanking her for the generous donation. Because they sent him a ton of money. Now we get into...
There's no mistaking his signature.
Right. Yeah. And the Eichhorn family were very, very strong supporters. Their graves are in the next town over, but they're not very well tended, and they're starting to show their age.
Got it. All right.
Now,
standing in picture number 55. All right, this is the mystery picture.
Yeah. We know what that salute is.
I recognize it. Yeah.
Yeah, except she should pull her thumb in. Who is that? When was it? That was Isabelita Perón, the president of Argentina, and this was in July of 1974.
Well,
1974 at Juan Perón's funeral. Interesting.
Totally.
She really needs to learn how to do that better.
Well, that's the thought behind it.
I will be in contact with her shortly. I finally found her.
She's still around.
Yes. She's 81 years old.
Uh-huh.
So, and then, let's see. The next one, number 57. This is...
Can't go by 56.
The guys all standing around, is that the one I'm talking about?
56 has a very unusual aircraft taking off or landing.
Oh, yeah, I got them backwards, 56 and 50. Yeah, I was watching this DVD that I got from this very nice old guy that showed me all around the headquarters of the Argentine Air Force. Very nice man, Juan Ignacio. He gave me... a small shopping bag full of souvenirs, including a hat and books and a couple of DVDs. And one DVD, Perón's Pilots, I'm watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 50s, I think this was, they had a camera set up, and they were taxiing their different airplane past the camera to show all their Air Force. And there were some airplanes that looked like crap. There's some other airplanes that looked really beautiful. And I'm sitting there watching, and all of a sudden this Horton Flying Wing taxis by. And I'm thinking, what the heck? Because we have a photo of a Horton flying over the Brazilian rainforest.
Uh-huh.
And now all of a sudden here in this film from the Argentine Air Force. So I sent another email to Juan Ignacio, and he said, yeah, the Hortons were there in Argentina designing
really
airplanes along with Kurt Tank and 50-something aircraft engineers. They snuck out of Germany to build airplanes down there for the Argentine Air Force. So they had flying wings. This is a modification. It looks like it's going to be a cargo plane or something. But the Horton brothers were there designing flying wings.
That's fascinating.
Lordy, lordy.
Yeah, yeah.
Then, of course, 57. This was taken in the late 40s. We think 1949.
Right.
At a picnic grove called El Chorrito, whatever that means, in the hills behind the Eden Hotel. And the yellow circle highlights the dagger in this guy's belt. That was a Hitler Youth dagger.
Yeah.
And he had been cutting meat from the grill. It's called an asado. That was Adolf Eichmann out there in La Falda.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wonder who the other guys were.
Those were just Argentine guys.
Mm-hmm. They looked pretty ethnic.
But because the Eichhorn family had introduced Eichmann to these guys, he was part of the inner circle, and we think he was there visiting, maybe visiting Adolf, but we don't know for sure yet.
Uh-huh. Someday this story will come out in a little more detail. People will talk. They're on the back cover of the book. Let's go to the back cover of the book. If you go back to the Rents homepage, look under the splash art at the top, which shows David D's wonderful cover.
Beautiful.
Click below it. You'll say, to see back cover, click here. Okay? And next to that, it says, to order, click here. That's a very important button to push. We want this book all over the world, and I think it's going to go. This is the book. This is a definitive story done with honor and integrity. It tells the truth. Look at the back cover of the book. I sent David three pictures. Two of them were put on the book. And actually, this is not the final version of the back cover, Harry, nor is that the final version of the front cover, but you'll get there.
It just needs to be trimmed down a little bit. Because
that is the front cover, correct, but the back cover.
Yeah.
Now, let me look at these two pictures with all of you real quickly. If any of you have a magnifying glass handy, I want to just point out a couple things. Number one, this is apparently, we believe, to be a picture of Adolf Hitler, frail, old, right before, not necessarily right before, but shortly before he died. Now look back at the picture on the left. I want you to look at the nostrils. Look at the nostrils. Hitler had an imbalanced pair of nostrils. His left nostril was lower than his right. His right nostril, our left as we look at it, was higher. They weren't exactly the same. Now, look at the general shape of the nose and then compare with the nose of the old man on the right. A forensic specialist could do this really well. Look at the general chin line. Look at the mouth. Look at the lips. The same mouth, but 20 to 30 years older and obviously very fatigued. Look at the ear carefully. And I would invite you to just type in Adolf Hitler and do a search for him, and just type in images. Click on images. Look at the various pictures. You'll see extraordinary similarities. There's even a scruff of a mustache on the old man growing right in the center. The chin has a dimple in it, which is not readily apparent in the earlier pictures. That could easily have been a plastic surgeon's knife that did that to give a different impression of the face, even though he would not have worn the mustache down there, of course. But this is a man, old, perhaps, who has had a stroke. The mouth is turned down. Take a close look at it. Study it. And see what you think. This is, and look at other pictures of him as well. I think you'll see an awful lot of similarities. And the last thing I want to mention is, look at the eye staring out at you from under the bandana. Look at the eye. There is an echo, an ancient echo of fire and passion in that eye. That is a very interesting picture. But
yeah,
do look at it.
That's the eye people said would hypnotize you.
That's right. And it's a very hypnotic eye in that picture. Look at other pictures of Adolf Hitler. Look at the nose. Look at the fleshy part of the lower part of the nose below the cartilage and see how that could easily be extrapolated upon, and what do you got? Okay.
Same
interesting
guy.
Interesting picture. Do we know where that picture came from?
It came from one of my associates down in Argentina.
Okay. All right. Well, that...
But it's pretty well been spread out onto the internet now. It's been picked up from someplace.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Once it gets on the internet, it's gone.
It's gone, and no pulling it back. All right, let me remind everyone that the book will be shipping in about 2 weeks, Hitler in Argentina by Harry Cooper, the definitive documented truth of Hitler and Eva Braun in Argentina for the rest of their lives. And we believe that Eva Braun died, what, 5, 6, 7 years ago, Harry?
That's what we figure.
Okay. There's more to this story. It's in the book. It's a fascinating book, and I would urge all of you, agree or disagree, read the book and make up your own minds. I'm not telling you what to think here, but do read this book. It is fascinating. Thank you, Harry.
It was so much fun putting it together.
Yeah, I know. I enjoyed a little bit of help I was able to give here and there, and we're going to keep pushing it, and it'll be out there. Thank you very much. Oh, of course, Harry. You take care. We'll talk soon, my friend. Good job. Congratulations.
Good. Thanks so much. You have a great evening.
Okay. Good night. Okay. Harry Cooper and the book Hitler in Argentina, the documented truth of his escape from Berlin. All right. We'll be back with more in just a few.